Hello and welcome to The Stack. This week on the show, we learn more about Vogue's history with Nina Sofia Mirales, plus the fascinating story of revolutionaries in Syria on a mission to rescue the books they could find in the bombed-out ruins of their hometown. And finally, we welcome back Holly Fraser from We Present. She tells me about their latest exciting projects. Enjoy the show. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up on the show, we have Holly Fraser from We Present and Nina Sofia Mirales, author of Glossy, the inside story of Vogue. But we start the show with a fascinating story from Syria that inspired Delphine Minois' book, The Book Collectors of Daraya. The author and Le Figaro correspondent look at a band of Syrian rebels and their mission to create an underground library among the bombed-out ruins of their hometown. I had the pleasure to speak with Delphine about this powerful story.
I have been covering the Middle East for the last 20 years. It all started at the end of the 90s when I decided to leave Paris, my hometown, to move to Iran, where my dad was originally from. So I moved to Iran, I started working there as a reporter, and what was supposed to be a 10-day trip ended up being a 10-year journey inside Iran. And once I got to know the Middle East culture, and once I got the chance to manage to, you know, break some sort of stereotypes, I decided to stay in the Middle East. So after Tehran, I lived in Lebanon, then I moved to Cairo in Egypt, and now I am based in Turkey, a country which is very close to Syria, a place that I've been covering for the last 10 years since the revolution started in 2011.
Well, and Turkey, I mean, some of those book collectors, which we'll talk a bit more, some of them, they moved there as well, right? It's been a country that actually kind of welcomed some of them, right?
Yes, indeed. Turkey is the number one country welcoming Syrian refugees. Nowadays, you have more than 3.5 million refugees, Syrian refugees living in Turkey. And among them, some of those guys who had sadly to leave Daraya because of the war, and now they live in Turkey.
It is very much a fascinating story, and what a brave, you know, group of people, because, you know, they've been to so much destruction, and but they still went, you know, to look out for those books. They knew the importance of that. How did you come across that fascinating story, actually, to decide to write a book about it, a documentary as well?
Yes, I mean, I as soon as I heard about the story, I couldn't help but trying to figure out what were all the details of the story. Like, you know, you in front of you, you have different pieces of a destroyed puzzle, and you want to assemble all the pieces and to recreate the story, because to me it's an extraordinary story about very ordinary people. I mean, those people are normal Syrian civilians, people who went to the streets at the beginning of 2011 to call for more justice, for more democracy, and they were faced with violence by the Syrian regime. And those people, sadly, at one point, as a journalist, as someone who has been covering the Middle East, I couldn't access them because, I mean, obviously, for the last years, we faced a lot of restrictions. I couldn't go to Damascus anymore. I was blacklisted by the regime. I couldn't access anymore the rebel-controlled areas because of the rise of the jihadis. Some of my friends and colleagues had been either arrested, kidnapped. Some of them, sadly, had been killed as well. And so one day, what happened is I was surfing through the web, through the internet, and I bump into a picture on a Facebook page called Humans of Syria. And this picture was literally a picture of two young guys surrounded by walls of books. So it looked like sort of a library, but there was no more details. There was just a tiny caption referring to a secret underground library in Daraya. And it really caught my attention. I was so surprised to see such a picture coming from Daraya, which I knew about. Daraya was one of the first cities who rose against the regime of Bashar al-Assad, and it was very quickly crushed. It was forced into a very long-term siege, four-year siege. It was daily bombed. It was faced with a lot of violence. And there was this huge contrast between this picture showing a peaceful atmosphere with books in the middle of a city which was in the middle of war. So what I did was like to try to contact the administrator of the Facebook page first, who kindly put me in touch with the photographer of this picture, who happened to be one of the co-founders of the library, and his name is Ahmad. So thanks to Ahmad, I managed to recompose this little puzzle with all these news scattered around related to Daraya, to this library. So days after days, weeks after weeks, Ahmad and his friends came behind my screen, basically behind my computer screen, and started telling me this amazing story of Daraya, this amazing project of saving books from the destroyed and bombed houses and creating an underground library in one of the basements of the city to protect those books, and also to turn this library into an underground university for all those guys.
I mean, that's amazing, because they're not only collecting books, but they're also at risk as well, because I'm sure the regime wouldn't like to see that. So, you know, that's kind of the bravery as well, which I find it fascinating. And which type of books? I mean, because actually you mentioned more at the end of the book, there's been a list. I was actually quite happy when a Brazilian author, Paulo Coelho, with The Alchemist, it was one of the favorites, right? That was quite interesting to see which types of books they were reading.
It's so interesting, because imagine a city which is totally cut from the world, which is totally isolated for 4 years, and in the same time facing daily bombing, sometimes 80 bombs per day. And among all of these books that they managed to save and start reading was a real window to the world. It was a huge diversity among those books. They had books on religion, books on philosophy, sociological volumes, as well as novels like Paulo Coelho, The Alchemist, which became really one of their favorite books, but also more surprising books from our own point of view, like self-help American books, like The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey, which is an international bestseller sold all around the world. But this is not such a book that you would expect people to read in a war zone.
I just loved. I think it's nice to put into perspective. I mean, what are they reading? What's your relationship with Dan at the moment? Because I know you've done a documentary about them, which aired in quite a few countries as well. Are you still in touch somehow?
Yes, we are still in touch, definitely. You know, I mean, it's a kind of story that you cannot forget about. It's the kind of story that will stick to me, I think, all my life. And this kind of relationship a journalist can have with a story is very rare. And I feel lucky and humble to have had the chance to build a bridge between those guys, between their hidden story and the world, to be able to tell about the reality on the ground in Syria, while those guys were portrayed as jihadis and terrorists by the Syrian regime. So obviously we're still in touch. We even have our own WhatsApp group called Daraya Reunited, because some of them are still living in Syria. They are displaced in northern Syria, in Idlib. Some of them are in Turkey. So we often see each other even for a cup of coffee, even if the cafe cafes are closed. We always meet in parks during the corona time. I also managed to help two of them to get political asylum in France. So Ahmad, my first contact from Daraya, nowadays he lives in Bordeaux, in one of the French cities, where he's learning French. And he's pursuing his dream of, at one point, becoming a professional cameraman, because he also used to be filming his friends when he was back then inside Daraya. And all together, we had this project 2 years ago that we managed to build up. We made a documentary together by mixing the amazing footage, those videos they had taken during the 4 year siege, with their situation now, with like their daily life today, to like I guess for one sake, for one goal, which is very important both for them and for me, is to try to immortalize this unique experience, this peaceful experience that the regime tried to destroy in the middle of the war.
That was Delphine Minois. The book Collectors of Daraya is out now. And now we welcome back on the show Holly Fraser, WePresent Editor-in-Chief, the creative platform for WeTransfer. Last year, WePresent saw a spike in the numbers of visitors to the website. More recently, they have announced a collaborative project on the climate crisis with the Serpentine, and also a new series led by Marina Abramovich. Holly tells me more about it.
Me and you would have spoken last February in, you know, blissful ignorance about what was around the corner. And we had just actually at the time launched our first in real life exhibition with Ronelle Medrano in London. And we were very excited about, you know, how we could use that as a model for the future. Obviously, a few weeks later, everything changed, you know, everything. But I think, you know, what we focused on during the pandemic from a WePresent point of view was, you know, continuing, I think, what we are doing. We always want to be a platform that inspires and enables, you know, the creative community and also the next generation of creatives. And we really worked on, you know, features and articles that I feel really did that. We also, you know, didn't want to add to the sort of pandemic content that became very, you know, ubiquitous across the internet and obviously across the news. And I think that what we wanted to do was make sure that we were still a platform that served up inspirational escapism across the pandemic. And, you know, that obviously resonated with our readers. We saw a huge spike actually in traffic in the March-April period. We went up to over 4 million readers in that time, which sort of continued pretty much throughout the entirety of last year. And in that time, we also kind of changed our approach a little bit to how we created editorial. One piece to mention, which you may have seen, was we worked with the Royal Academy on their summer exhibition, which actually did turn into the winter exhibition because it opened in October. But, you know, so many institutions were suffering because of the pandemic and obviously couldn't open. And the Royal Academy, interestingly, had not ever shut down their summer exhibition in 252 years. And obviously the pandemic then came and was a threat to that. But we worked with them to create the first ever digital experience for the exhibition, where all, I think it was 1,172 artworks were displayed in a WeTransfer wallpaper, which allowed people that couldn't make it to the exhibition to sort of click through the wallpaper and sort of stay and see all of this amazing art from the comfort and importantly safety of their living room. So I think, you know, while obviously it goes without saying the pandemic has been, you know, atrocious for so many reasons and also for the creative community, it's forced us to really look at ways that we can still, you know, interact with people and bring creativity into their lives in different ways. And I think innovating has been something that has been, you know, quite exciting to our team and is something that we'll take forward when this hopefully is all over as well.
Well, before we talk about a series of interesting projects you have for this year, I want to talk about the yearly book that you guys produce. I mean, it's amazing because it just shows it's kind of nice for those that follow WePresent, how much good stuff you did in 2020. Can you tell us a bit more about the book? I mean, great features with Orville Peck, which I really love, and even Rodriguez. I mean, it's so much content in there. I love it.
Well, thank you very much. So we always create a We Present magazine, an annual, if you will, and it comes out at the end of each year. This was the first time that we had actually created one remotely, which we probably underestimated how much work that would be to create an entire 200 odd page magazine over Zoom. So hats off to the entire editorial team who really pulled it out of the bag. And I think, you know, if you've seen the magazine, it's we feel at least a real kind of work of art and testament to how we were able to carry on through a really difficult year. But I think, you know, what we wanted to do with the magazine is be able to send it out to, you know, our community and to the artists that we had worked with across the year as a little bit of, you know, a nice little piece of inspiration, I guess, that came out just before Christmas, but also to highlight the projects that we had done. I think one of the things that we found really difficult actually as a team was this feeling of being stuck in a little bit of a hamster wheel across the year. You know, we were working constantly in our, you know, bedrooms and living rooms on Zoom to get these amazing projects out. And then because we couldn't come together and celebrate, there was a real moment of, okay, this has gone out, but what do we do now? Let's just, you know, is it straight on to the next one? And I think it's really important as a team to be able to come together and celebrate the wins and the successes that you have, you know, when a project goes live. So I think for us, you know, when the magazine actually landed in all of our houses and we kind of had a minute to look through it, it brought home just, you know, how hard we had worked as a team and how hard the year had been. But there was this kind of light at the end of the tunnel of this really beautiful publication that highlighted the amazing work that we'd been able to do across the year and the absolutely incredible artists that we had the, you know, the real pleasure of collaborating with, which was, you know, kind of immense. And I think we kind of captured it at the end of the magazine. We figured out that we have to date worked with over 1,000 artists from over 100 countries around the world, which is, you know, I don't want to toot our own trumpet, but I think it's kind of impressive. So that was a real nice moment for the team as well.
Oh, it is very impressive. And more recently, I mean, this week, We Present has a kind of a new curator series. And you're starting with quite a big name. Tell us more.
Spoiler alert. Yeah, no, we are. We Present has always, you know, curated amongst our own team. The artists that we feature, we come together on a monthly basis and figure out, you know, how we can spotlight different parts of the world with creativity and look at different artists. But, you know, one of the things we were thinking of this year is why don't we hand that kind of mantle over to some of the artists that we really, really admire. And, you know, I wonder who some of these great names are looking at as the next big thing and who's coming next. So the first person that we have the immense privilege to be able to work with is Marina Abramović, who is, you know, one of the most incredible artists working today in our opinion. And we'll be working with Marina on a project that spans, I think it's about 6 months actually. So starting with her being our guest curator for March. So she'll be choosing 5 performance artists that she thinks the world needs to know about. And it's funny, we were meant to launch this last year in tandem with Marina's exhibition at the Royal Academy, but obviously because of the pandemic, it got moved. So we've kind of kept it under our hats for the best part of a year and are so delighted that we can, you know, finally shout about it. And as I say, the guest curatorship will be the first part of this kind of, you know, collaboration. But following on from that, Marina will be, you know, and I won't say too much, I don't want to give it away, but Marina will be working to create a number of exclusive wallpapers for WeTransfer users. And it will also culminate in a big We Present project in September, which will look at, you know, Marina's amazing and, you know, illustrious career over the last however many years that she has been working. So for us, it was, you know, a huge honor, I think. Marina and her team actually reached out to us to initiate the partnership, which again was a huge honor for our team and something that we grabbed with both hands when it kind of came our way. So we're really excited to launch this curator series, and Marina will be the first of hopefully many curators that we work with over the next few years as well.
That was Holly Fraser from We Present. For more, go to wepresent.wetransfer.com. And finally on the show, a delightful new title telling us the history of Vogue since its first issue 125 years ago. Glossy, the inside story of Vogue, goes through American Vogue, British Vogue, and Vogue Paris through the years. From the rise of Anna Wintour to the magazine's historical importance during the war, it's all in there. I spoke to the author of Glossy, Nina Sofia Mirales, for more.
I definitely grew up reading about them. I was obsessed, probably like every teenage girl, getting the Vogues every month. So it was very religious sort of approach, you know, back then, tearing out the pictures and putting them on your wall. And it was all serious business because it was the only place that you could learn about fashion so easily. So definitely it was always, always part of my life.
And it's fascinating that it's 125 years old. I mean, it's incredible that they are still around and kind of expanding. How was the early years of Vogue? I mean, I'm sure it was very different from what we know today.
So Vogue is like, it has a great spirit of survival and kind of a bit like the phoenix. Every time it goes down in flames, it somehow gets back on its feet again. It's really sort of a marvel of reinvention. And it always has been right from the very beginning. So the early Vogue was created by a man called Tonio. He loved magazines in general, and it wasn't a fashion magazine. It was fashion and society. Lots of stories about rich people at fancy balls. But he started it to kind of glorify himself and his friends as the richest New Yorkers and kind of important Americans. So it was a bit like a PR exercise as well. And then after him, when Condé Nast, who was a man, now we know his name is the company name, came in, he sort of changed it all around quite a lot, and it became really about advertising and fashion then. So every few decades, I would say, it sort of pivots quite successfully, and it continues to do so. And I think that's what's seen it through so long, you know, 100 plus years.
That's fascinating. What about Vogue Paris? I mean, I always have this impression, you know, the French, of course, they have an incredible fashion scene. I mean, how did they feel to have like a version of an American title originally? What was the story of the story of Vogue Paris?
Yeah, so that, you're quite right, was kind of difficult to convince the French to open their doors, but essentially, so it wasn't so much hard to get into the market because they had a lot of contacts from, you know, design and so on. And the Americans did something very clever where they invested for years in a series of very popular French magazines, art, culture, and fashion magazines, so that the publishers of those magazines, kind of French people with really strong connections, sometimes aristocrats, sometimes very wealthy estate owners, those people already knew them and were willing to work with them. So they kind of got the best staff available by bribing them slowly over the years. No, it wasn't bribery, but by working with them for a long time prior, yeah. The importance of Vogue Paris, really, why they had to start an issue there, even though it lost a lot of money at the beginning, was to maintain contacts with the designers. Because over in America, it was obviously very far. And as Americans, they were culturally very different. So Vogue Paris was almost a little bit like a front at the beginning to build relationships with people like, you know, Chanel, Vionnette, you know, all the designers who had a lot of attitudes and wouldn't let you see the collections if you just showed up from New York.
And what I like, I mean, I love reading about kind of Vogue, because I think it is an interesting title. We can't deny that. But there's even some aspects, for example, I mentioned to you before the interview, there was Vogue Paris invited Nelson Mandela to be the guest editor back in 94. So, you know, fairly political at the time. And sometimes we see Vogue today and we say, oh my God, they're becoming quite political because the world is changing. But there were some signs of that already, you know, even in the 90s.
Absolutely. So Vogue, interestingly enough, kind of each separate Vogue in each country used to have a lot of control, the editors in chief, on, you know, the style and the taste. So it was really up to the personality of the editor. And you're completely right. Now we look at, for example, what Edward Enerfel is doing in London and the UK, and it seems so progressive. So, you know, that kind of diversity and inclusion hasn't been done before in Vogue and so on. But it's not so much that nobody has done it. Plenty of people have done it in Vogue. It's just that this is the first time the public is receptive to it. So before, when editors tried to put, for example, black models on the cover of Vogue Paris, they got fired for it. It's just that this is the first time, you know, that people are ready to accept, you know, putting more Black models at the front, for example. And yeah, correct. So Vogue Paris was very political in the 90s under the editor-in-chief Colombe Pringle, who was kind of making it her mission to almost educate Vogue subscribers in Paris, who would typically be kind of like a very luxury-focused, maybe very privileged, slightly out-of-touch women. And she wanted to push major global issues like, you know, the apartheid in South Africa into their minds. But the problem is, it wasn't a time people weren't ready to care about that kind of stuff. And she did get fired for putting Nelson Mandela on the cover. In the same way, in fact, that she also put the Dalai Lama on the cover and talked a lot about mindfulness and, you know, thoughtful dressing. Not consumerism, basically. And that's something we talk about a lot now, but back then they hated that too.
Wow, that's fascinating. But what about the future of Vogue? I mean, do you think, do they still have it, you know, in a way? Of course, there's always challenges. I mean, the world of magazines and publishing is changing, you know, by the year. But how do you see the future of Vogue? Will we see more, 100 years more of Vogue?
100 years more of Vogue. So judging by what they're doing at the moment, they're very, very focused on digital. And that's what they keep pushing. They have an entertainment channel, YouTube videos, a new CEO who is from a tech background, not a publishing background. They want to be a media company, not a magazine. And I think that is daring, but also, you know, it kind of goes away from their legacy and what they're really known for, what they're really good at, and is maybe a bit too trendy. And as we know, trends change. I'm not super impressed with what they're doing at the moment, because the digital, deciding to go more digital, and in their approach in the magazines, it's all about mass market, kind of trying to reach bigger, broader audience. And I think for a magazine that is built essentially on luxury and elitism, it's very difficult to do that. And really, they should, in my opinion, have stuck to their niche. And of course, mass market approach means usually less creativity, less experimentation, less art, because it just follows trends. So that makes it somewhat less interesting.
That was Nina Sofia Mirales, author of Glossy, The Inside Story of Vogue. The book is out now. Well, that's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Nora Hull. If you have any comments or queries, feel free to write to me, Fernando, at fb@monaco.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. And of course, you can always listen to it again at monaco.com or subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and SoundCloud. And before we go, a little song for you. RuPaul with Cover Girl. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time, it's goodbye from me. Stroll down the runway, another payday, cover of magazines. And when they see me, they won't